Welcome to the Jacob's Well podcast. These messages are intended to feed you some great stuff that you can really dig your teeth into all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime, along with other great resources and ways to keep the conversation going at jacobs-well.net/leftovers. Enjoy the message.
Good morning, Jacob's Well. Good to see you all here today. I'm Greg Meyer, and it's great to be with you this morning and share some thoughts here. That video that you saw comes from Bihar province, a very poor place in India that where people are stuck in a lot of generational poverty and hunger, in a country where there is lots of generational poverty and hunger, but particularly in an area like this. And chances are this morning when you came here, you know about people in those kinds of situations around the world, but you probably didn't know about those people. You probably didn't know about that woman and what her situation is. But the thing is, now you do. And if you're like me, well, as soon as I know that, I ask a couple of questions. The first question I ask is, like, what could be done about that? And the question that follows it is, what could I do about it? And one of the really amazing things is that we know how to help her and the rest of the people in her situation. We know how to raise them up to the point where they are able, through agriculture, to support themselves and actually make some money and get out of that generational poverty. And we know how to do it using local resources, which is an amazing thing. The thing is, this someone has to do it. And is there going to be someone who does it? That's sort of the big question. So welcome to our fifth week of Supernatural. This series is bringing us on up to Easter. And we're calling this series, which is all talking about God, we're calling it Supernatural, but it's not. We're not talking about the supernatural sense of God that maybe is what we usually think of when we think about God, and that God is like otherworldly and bizarre and completely foreign and different from our world. But we're talking about God being supernatural, and the God is supernatural. Like, God is so deeply woven in how God interacts with us, is so deeply woven into our world that it feels like the most natural way of living is to understand how God is part of it. And in fact, without seeing God, when we understand God that way, without having God in our world with us, it feels like there's something missing. Like, we aren't getting the whole picture, and we're living in a world where we don't understand what it's all about and what's really going on. So what we're trying to do is to turn that around a little bit and look at that. And this means looking at God differently than God is most often looked at. And there are a lot of very popular ways of understanding God and of people interacting with God that are very different than that, and I think are very unhelpful and very unhealthy, and they lead us into, well, they lead us into some of the problems, which is why we're talking about this. Because we're not talking about God, we're not talking about this series and spending all this time talking about God so you'll get your theology straight or so that we can teach doctrine. We're doing it because it changes how we live. It changes how we treat each other. It changes our expectations with the world and how we try to interact with God and the kind of support, the kind of relationship with God that we have and that we translate into the world. One way that we think and talk about God is like this, and there's a picture here. There's a man named Stuart Feuerstein. He's a neurophysicist, a neuroscientist at Columbia University, who talks about this in a wonderful way and kind of gave me some of this language, which is a very Jacob's Well kind of thing. But we think of the world and universe, we think of understanding God kind of like this. We have a room. We have a very, very big room, all right, which is our universe, and we have to fill it up with these boxes. And these boxes are the stuff we learn. This is the information, the facts that we collect. And we collect them when we start filling them into the universe until we kind of have a handle on it, to where our job is to fill the room. And guess what happens when we fill the room? We got it. Now we know it all. And we have figured everything out. Now, somehow we think, you know, our books on theology and the lectures from smart professors and stuff like that will help us understand God and stuff till we finally have an answer to this. And we know how God works, and then we can go tell other people how God works and what God says to them and what God is telling them to do and what they shouldn't do and all that kind of stuff. maybe this won't happen in our lifetime, but we can see it happening, and we are part of filling up the room. In fact, then that's how we deal with all of the world, isn't it? I mean, you know, we go and try to learn enough. We try to create our mountain of knowledge so that we don't have to worry about stuff anymore. We can now live securely and take care of the things that are bothering us, that we're worried about. If I could just get that one more little bit of information. With that perspective, with this perspective, the purpose of a question is to find an answer. It's to know something. That's what life is about. We have questions so that we could know something. When we do this with our lives, we think and we find security in knowing what we have to know. That's why talk shows with celebrities and experts, usually not to be confused, are so popular. And we are befuddled why people so often, they have the facts, like we tell them what they need to know, but they don't change the way they think. They don't change their behaviors. You know, they still keep smoking, they still keep drinking, they still, eat wrong, or they run up bills on their credit cards, or who knows what it might happen to be. They vote for the wrong political party, which one ever that happens to be, even though they know all the facts, and I told them twice, you know? Or we wonder, like, I did all the stuff you're supposed to do. I ate right. I was careful what cleaners I used in my house, and I still got cancer. It's not supposed to happen. I followed the rules. How did this happen? What's this all about? Maybe there's something wrong with that picture. Maybe it isn't a good picture of God. Maybe it isn't a good way to understand life. It's that somehow on this mountain of facts, mountain of information, which kind of sounds a lot to me like the Tower of Babel from the Old Testament, that somehow that doesn't get us everything that we need to have. Maybe we need to think about it a little bit more. So Feuerstein proposes another image, and that is of ripples on the water. What if learning wasn't the process of filling up the room with information and facts until we have it all, but it was an infinite experience, kind of like the universe, that keeps spreading outward? What if the ripples of what we know and what we've learned, the facts and the info that we've accumulated, not bad things, but ever expanding as they are, weren't filling up the room, but taking us further into the unknown, and there's no end to that? What if the way the world worked, the way we understood God, wasn't that questions lead to answers, but the purpose of knowing something, the purpose of having an answer, was to ask another and a better question? So yes, questions bring us information and answers, hopefully, but doesn't stop there. The reason we have those answers, the reason we have that information, is to ask another question. What if discovering God wasn't about our certainty of our doctrines and our religious divisions and decisions, but it was a lifetime of asking better and better questions? What if life wasn't about accumulating anything, but when we got older and hopefully wiser, we aren't feeling like, gee, now I finally understand everything, you know, now I know what I wish I would have known when I was younger, but we're suddenly just feel like we're starting to zero in on what we really want life to even be about at all. And maybe that's good enough. So in a world of infinite possibilities, and this is on your on the outline in your Sunday paper, if you're, you flip over your Sunday paper, you'll see that, and you're welcome to follow along. But what if it's like this? In a world of infinite possibilities, the world is not grasped by the quantity of your knowledge, but the quality of your ignorance. Now, I use the word ignorance there specifically. By that, I'm not talking about stupidity. I'm not talking about purposeful, like, I just don't want to know. I'm going to disregard the facts. I'm not talking about just the unawareness of things at all like that. I use the word ignorance to say this intentionally realizing what you don't know. Intentionally realizing what you don't know. So what if the universe isn't grasped by the quantity of your knowledge, but the quality of your ignorance? Maybe the real question is, how good are your questions? Maybe that's what you really have to sport. You know, as I think about corporate America and the leadership stuff that I'm talking about, often the person that the companies are really looking for is the person who could ask the right question right now, because we know all the answers we have are going to be gone, they're not going to be useless in a couple of years. Who can ask the right question for the future? I wonder if that isn't true just about everywhere. And that would change how we see God and how we would package God, wouldn't it? I mean, doesn't this model assume that there is always more that we don't know than what we do know? And therefore, every time you learn anything, it just means there is now a faster rate and expansion of what you don't know. It almost makes it sound a little bit futile to try to learn anything because all you do is find out that how much more you don't know. But I think that's the stuff that we're really looking for in life. I think that's where we're being led. And there's some really good reason to believe that this isn't a heretical new 21st century spin on sort of some ancient and truths, but this is really what the Bible was trying to tell us all along. Somehow those ancient minds had this figured out long, long before we started packaging religion and reducing God and limiting God and putting God into that room full of boxes. I mean, just think about this. This is a couple of passages from Exodus, right? The very beginning of the Bible, Moses is being called by God to lead the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. And so Moses is having this heart-to-heart talk with God, right? And God says, I want you to do this incredibly audacious task. I want you to walk up to the Pharaoh and say, let my people go, and I want you to lead them to a promised land. You know, all right, no problem, right? So Moses and God have this conversation. Moses says to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Kind of a basic question, maybe. Then what am I going to tell them? And God says to Moses, this is in English, but in Hebrew, in English, tell them, I am who I am. That's not a name. What do you mean, I am who I am? This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. Now, that I am is signified by that in Hebrew on the top, or the transliterated in English, YHWH, the name that when it's written, if you actually see it in Hebrew, would be pronounced Yahweh, but you're not supposed to say that. That's the tetragrammaton. Tetragrammaton means four letters, and those are the four letters. And Hebrews didn't ever want to say that because that's the name of God. You don't say the name of God because you might get struck dead or something if you say the name of God. So it was just always represented that way, and they learned to say a different word. They would say Adonai instead of Yahweh. So there's this huge what's going on here? What is that all about? Why does God give an answer like, my name's, you know, why can't God just say George, you know? Why does God say, I am who I am? And why do the Hebrews instinctively feel like this is a name we shouldn't say? I mean, yeah, we can say it's because it's prohibited, you're not supposed to, there's a rule against it. Or is it because they understood something about God? As soon as we name God and we think we've got God, what we're doing is we're standing on the last ripple that we feel comfortable with, and we're looking back towards the center and saying, big enough for me. I now want to turn around and see what's out there. I want to contain it here. I want to stop it here. One of the commandments, again, in Exodus, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven, above or on the earth beneath, or the earth beneath or in the waters below. It's this prohibition against graven images. In other words, making anything that represents God. You're not supposed to do that. Islam has the same thing. We saw that with the Charlie Hebdo thing, right? This prohibition of depicting Muhammad or depicting God or Allah, too. What's that all about? Is it simply that's a prohibition? You're not supposed to do it. God gets upset? Or is it just God embedded in the minds of the people that understood God from early, early on, that as soon as we represent God, as soon as we carve God, we've limited God. We've reduced God. We've captured God. We've packaged God. And all we have to do is pretend we're in that room, we can fill it up with our boxes, and we've got God. And God says, I don't want to be kept in a room. I want you to be on this ripple. I want you riding it out into this ever-expanding world of stuff that I need you to discover, and I need you to be a part of. Okay, scissors or glue? You all got the connection, right? No, me either. No, I do, actually. Here's where I'm going with this. We take this certainty that we get out of our mountain of information and facts, and we use it to keep order in our world. It likes to understand the world and God, that mountain of facts and issues. And it likes to do it the way that we've already noted. In fact, every one of us in this room, everyone in this world has a different mountain of facts and a different mountain of information. And guess what? Each of us have the right one, right? One of our jobs is to convince other people to accept ours and make decisions or live in ways that are like ours. If for no other reason, it just makes our life easier if they do. because they don't keep rocking our boat. And people who represent a very different mountain of information and facts, it just is too hard for us to incorporate into ours. So we find all kinds of reasons why we wouldn't include them, why we would decide they're wrong, why we would cut them out, the scissors. We use the way we understand the world to be our scissors, and God is the ultimate trump card of that. If my facts, if my mountain of facts and information come from God, then it's not me telling you you're wrong, it's God telling you you're wrong. So argue with me all you want, but you're going to have to talk to the big guy, you know? So it's the ultimate trump card. I protected my world. I've limited, I've controlled it so that I can be comfortable in it, and I can stand out there on the most comfortable ring of the ripples and look back towards the center and say, I got this. I got this. I know what it's all about. But I don't think that's what it is. Here's the question. Is God and are you scissors to snip away, to cut away at what doesn't belong? Or are you glue to fasten what could belong? Are you and is God trying to include and trying to bring us all and to help us to be one? Interestingly, the verse in the Bible that is often most used to call people in, you know, to this oneness in God, John 3:16, that's the football game one, right? For God so loved the world that God gave God's only Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish but will live. We use that. We're supposed to be calling people in, but we're really telling everybody, you know, be like us, see it the way we do, believe it the way we do. But we forget about the verse that follows after it, that keeps going, for it says, for he, Jesus, did not come to judge the world, but to save, or really if that word in Greek, to preserve the world. If Jesus wasn't sent to judge, if Jesus wasn't sent to snip away and to tell people who was in and who was out, but was there to preserve, to make us whole, to keep us together, why did it become our job to do it? Why do we use God as our ammunition to keep people out, tell people where they belong, rather than finding creative ways of understanding one another and belonging to one another? I don't know. So if God is glue, sticking us together when we get separated, bonding us with connections of emotion and interdependence and curiosity and who knows what else, so that we could be one, why isn't that our job as well? And when I say one, I think it's important to understand what one looks like, probably in a realistic way of understanding our world. It isn't like the puzzle that has a few pieces missing, that everyone has its own spot and gradually you get all the pieces in there and it's just nice and tidy and finished. But it's one maybe like water is one. You know, all the water on our planet is water. It's been the same water forever. There hasn't been more water added to the world. It's been circulating between rivers and lakes and oceans and aquifers and reservoirs underneath the earth. It's been rising up as humidity into the sky and been clouds and come down as rain and then been on glaciers and ice for millions and millions and millions of years circulating. And it's all the same water, whether it's filling a bucket or filling an ocean or filling a thimble, it's water. And it's one. And it appears in so many different ways. And so we are one. Maybe that's a little bit healthier vision of how to do that. So, on your outlines, and this is a Jacob's Well core value, unity can be achieved by enforcing conformity. All right? We can have unity by I tell you all what you're supposed to believe and how you're supposed to act, and then we'll be like one, and then we know what to do with the people who won't conform. Or it can be by embracing diversity. We can also be united by embracing the diversity and saying it all belongs here. We're all part of a body with different functions and different purposes and different perspectives. Some we will never truly understand quite how it is that we're a part of it. And certainly we are all under a process of transformation and change. And by saying that we all belong here and we're all part of this body and that we're all part of this great diversity doesn't mean that everything we do and think is right. But we're in this process of figuring this out together. So I don't want to argue this anymore. What I would like to think about is this conviction that God is glue, and that's kind of what we're to be about too. We're to be glue people, sticking stuff together, God's agents in the world doing this, holding the world together and breathing life into it. And I want to spend the rest of our time this morning looking at some people who have been doing a great job of doing this. And first of all, you got Callie up there? Oh, there she is. Hey, Callie.
Hi.
I think most of you know Callie Plago. She's Jacob's Waller. She was sitting right there last Sunday. She's in Santiago, Guatemala right now.
Hello.
Hi. Everybody. Can you hear me, Callie?
Yeah, I can hear you well.
Okay, so Callie started at the ripe old age of 25, started a nonprofit in Guatemala to work with young men particularly. And you're down there with your project right now?
Yes.
Let me turn it over to you, Callie.
Okay. Well, it's really great to see you, except I can't see you. I see Lizzie in the back. Let's pretend I see everybody. We've been here since Wednesday, and we'll be here until Wednesday. And this is my mission. At Jacob's Well, we talk about ministry and mission, the M&M. Salus is what I consider to be my mission. In Jacob's Well, my ministry would be running the volunteers in the cafe, so I hope you all are enjoying coffee this morning that Mary made. But here we are. I'm sitting with Romeo. He's our program director here in Guatemala. He runs everything. He runs the show. And he and I have been friends. We're celebrating our 15th year of friendship. I met him in the year 2000, and Salus was actually founded in 2006. So we knew each other for quite a while before I had the idea to start Salus. So I want to invite him to say a word or two about whatever he wants, and I'll just set that up. ¿Quieres decir algo?
Gracias por la bendición de tener de compartir con ustedes en esta mañana.
He said, "Thank you for the blessing that it is to be able to share with you in this way this morning."
No he tenido la oportunidad de estar en esa iglesia, pero algún día.
I haven't had the opportunity to be at your church with you, but hopefully someday I will.
Y aquí está Cali y el grupo gozando. Muchas bendiciones acá en el Ministerio de Salud.
And Callie's here with us with the team of the board of directors and having a joyful time sharing in fellowship with our youth of Salud.
Desde el primer día que están aquí en Guatemala ha sido de bendición para nosotros, para nuestros jóvenes y gracias por ese grupo que ha venido aquí con bendición.
It's ever since the very first day that she came to start this ministry, it's been a huge blessing for us and our youth in Guatemala, and it's a blessing to have them here as a group.
Y a ustedes también, que Dios les bendiga desde allá de Estados Unidos.
Thank you to you guys, all of you in the United States.
Y a todos, al pastor y a toda la iglesia, que Dios les bendiga.
To the pastor and to the whole church, God bless you. And so, yeah, I repeat a lot of what he said. You guys are, as individuals within a congregation, you're very supportive of the work that we do here, and I am deeply grateful for your support. So it's great to be able to Skype with you and, you know, talking about the glue and how, you know, not forcing conformity. I think that Salus is a really good example of that. There's a lot of diversity in the way things are done between the United States and Guatemala, definitely, and cultural differences. And we try our best to not push too much of our United States ideals onto them, but partner with them in ministry. So I'm really proud of the work that we're doing down here.
What kind of projects do you have going on? What's happening while you're down there, Callie?
Well, on Friday, we participated with the youth in a project at a church, a local church, and we did construction with drywall, which is really odd down here, but we did drywall walls to divide Sunday school classrooms. And so I'll just show you some of the, two of the Sunday school teachers are right here with me. That's Romeo's wife, his daughter Dina and Jenny, and they teach the Sunday school at the church where we built Sunday school classrooms. And here's Doobie, the son of the family. And then tomorrow we're going to go visit projects that have been done in the last year and meet the families that were served. And I expect a lot of great testimonies to come out of that. And then we're also going to go visit sites of potentially, hopefully, projects for the future and meet those families and hear about their needs.
And if
so
I...
Hopefully,
Oh, I was going to say, if I can kind of summarize what the whole strategy behind Say Lose is that there's such a the main opportunity, particularly for young men in Guatemala and these urban areas, is to get involved with gangs.
That's right.
There's really not many other choices. So by creating these service projects and getting the young men together to do this and developing different values, and they're not only repurposing their own lives, but then actually contributing to the community, which sort of becomes a healthy spiral. So it's an amazing idea.
Thank you. Celos has stepped into that vacuum and provided a positive experience for the youth that where they can be constructive citizens in their society, in their community, rather than destructive. So it's definitely a positive spiral that we've seen happen over the last 9 years.
Fantastic. You probably have better weather than we do, but we won't dwell on that.
Beautiful here. Sunny.
Okay. And so we'll see you next week, I guess, or the week after. We'll look forward to more stories, but thank you for your work, and thank you for being some glue in this world.
Thank you. Thanks to Jacob as well. And God.
So just a quick thought about glue, and this is on your papers. Glue is, first of all, it's willing to be stretched. It's willing to be stretched. It's willing to be tested. It wants to find out, you know, what it can do. Glue also trusts other people. That's hard. But glue trusts other people. It also sacrifices for other people. It doesn't just do what's convenient, what's easy, what's automatic, what can be done without thinking about it, but it sacrifices for other people. It also learns from those people as it's doing it. It learns from others. And then the last one is, I really believe glue believes it's all for gain. It's all good. And even when it doesn't work right, even when it doesn't quite happen, and maybe even things backfire on you, that's part of the learning. That's what glue does. It does it all for gain. If you think about that, glue is willing to be stretched. It trusts other people, sacrifices for others, learns for others, believes that it's all for gain. And then maybe with that in your head, rehear these overly familiar verses from 1 Corinthians 13. You probably heard them a million times at weddings. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. That doesn't sound like a room full of boxes. That sounds like being on this ever-expanding spiral of ripples stretching out into what is left for us. We have another person who has a great message for us. I invite you to come on up here, Mike. This is Mike Johnson, who works with Lutheran World Relief. And he's going to share a little bit about some of the glue that he's part of and that we're also able to be a part of. So welcome. Thanks for being here with us today.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. So Mike, you work with Lutheran World Relief. And frankly, I know a lot about them just because I've been around the shop a long time. And I know that they are really well known around the world, but people here in the United States, we don't know a lot about Lutheran World Relief. Can you just tell us a little bit, first of all?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I really appreciate it. We have offices around the world, and really our purpose is to help those people that live in marginalized communities around the world. We have offices in 16 countries, and last year we did projects in 35 countries. And most of them are in the poorest of the poor countries, the ones that that don't have economic security or they're stuck in poverty. A lot of them are landlocked countries in Africa and Latin America. I'm going to talk a little bit about a specific project in India. That's why the map is up right now. We started in 1945, just after World War II, and there were a lot of family members that were still dealing with the aftermath of all of the destruction in Europe. And so there were people here in the United States that had family over there. They decided they wanted to send some food, some quilts, some clothing. And actually, it wasn't expected to be a long-term organization, but after a couple of years, they realized that they were pretty good at it. And actually, India was one of the next countries that they started working in. Brazil was another one. And since 1945, we've been doing projects around the world. So
that's great. So what gets you involved with all this sort of stuff? Why do you, if, from what I know of your resume, you had a more successful line of life going at one point.
Right, right. So yeah,
profitable.
I came out of, I feel pretty successful now doing what I do.
I think so.
Yeah, I came out of the banking world. I live in Stillwater, Minnesota. I'm a local kid. Actually, my mom and dad grew up just on the other side of the freeway. My dad would have gone to Washburn, but he was a De La Salle kid, so in the neighborhood. And live in Stillwater now. Have been with LWR for the last couple of years. And really, for me, it goes back to one of the verses in Matthew that talks about God is basically saying, if you take care of the least of these, you are taking care of me. Kind of like what Callie is doing. I mean, I got kind of emotional just seeing she's doing something and an awesome thing to bring about change in an area that doesn't have a lot of hope. And that's really what attracted me to LWR is the work that we do brings hope into the communities that we work in. So we have an office in Baltimore, Maryland. That's our headquarters. We have about 60 people in the United States on staff. About 45 are in Baltimore. We have an office in downtown Minneapolis, just up the road. We have 9 people in that office. And my work personally is to work with our individual donors and our congregations that support us financially. And I have the western part of the U.S., so I mean, just a small territory. I travel quite a bit, and mostly domestic. We have international program people that take care of the people outside. Well, let me share a little bit about, you saw Mina in that video earlier. If we can go back to here's a picture of Mina and her son. Could you go back to the map? In India, I mean, it's a country that in some pockets they're prospering. It's an amazing economy, but that's not hitting all places. There are still extreme poverty where people basically know that they're going to eat for 3 or 4 months of the year. The other 9 or 10 months, they're scrambling to figure out what to eat. And in the world, most people that live in the rural areas farm. They live off the land. And that's the case here. In that green province, Bihar, that's actually considered the poorest department or state in India. And so that's where we've been working for quite a long time. And we partner with local organizations. We happen to partner in this the project that Mina is a part of with Pradhan, which is an India-based NGO, non-governmental organization. So they help prepare and they do a lot of the work with us. We work with them directly about what should we be doing in this area. Well, we decided to do a project. It actually encompasses 25 small villages. There's about 500 families that are farmers. And they include the husband and wife and their kids. So it's about 2,600 people total that this is affecting. Mina is a pretty average story in this community. They are mostly rice farmers, and they've been rice farmers for generations. And when it rains well, they eat well, but most of the year is pretty dry. And so what we did in partnership with Pradhan is we worked to bring farmers together in what we would consider a co-op or a farmer association and help to teach them how do they work together to help the people around have more food. That's really the first thing was that they have enough food in their stomach that they're not going to bed hungry every single night. The second thing is if you only eat rice, that's not real healthy. So how do you help people to have a diverse diet? And so we actually helped this community to do vegetables. And kind of like in areas in the United States that are really dry, if you add water there, like California or Arizona, things grow really well. And they can have multiple growing seasons. And that's what's happened with Mina. In the story at the beginning, it talked about that when she was sick, she would need to either borrow from a loan shark, which is not a good thing, high interest rates, and repay that back, or use the seed that they were going to use to create the next crop. They use that to feed their family. Then that's not a good thing, because their future then is in jeopardy. So we've gone in and worked specifically to help Mina and her village and the villages around that area to have water for irrigation, to have a diverse way of basically creating more vegetables in their diet, and actually having some surplus, bringing food to market so that they can have a surplus so that if somebody in their family or in their village gets sick, they can support them. If somebody is needs to be in school, which is a big part of Pradhan's focus, is if we can bring education into the communities, then the communities can get themselves out of poverty. So one of the questions, Greg, you asked earlier was, what can we do about this? And one of the things that we can do specifically for Mina is to work with KindSight, which is a web page that we've created, a system that we've created at Lutheran World Relief, that you know specifically what your dollars are going to. It is for a specific project. And what we'd like to do, I know there's been a handful of people that have run marathons for people that don't have so much in other parts of the world. And we'd actually like to do that with you all for Mina and her village through KindSight. So what I'd like to do is offer an opportunity for people to raise money by doing something very transformational for yourself in running a marathon and getting ready for that in October, and have an opportunity to share the story of Mina and the project in India to bring that to people that you know already. So I know that's a big thing, to run a marathon.
It's not very far, is it?
Well, it depends. That's a relative question. 26 miles is a long way, yes.
So why would we want to do that?
Yeah. Well, for a few reasons. I know most people in here would say, I'm never going to run a marathon. But I would tell you that I think, just in looking around here, almost everyone in this room could run a marathon. And the fact that you would be willing to do something for somebody else. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to run a marathon, but I think the most important thing to do is to do something for somebody else. It's kind of amazing. I didn't know that the 1 Corinthians piece was going to be in our worship Sunday paper this morning. But really, love is one of the most powerful emotions that helps you to do something. And it is through love that takes... How do you love your neighbor? Well, one way you can love your neighbor, and Mina is our neighbor. One way that you can love your neighbor is to do something outside of your comfort zone with a group of people, us together, and I would be helping, to do something that's big, that would accomplish some great things for this community in India.
So maybe when I'd be asking, like, why would I do this, the answer isn't a fact or another piece of information, but it's a person.
Right.
And when I wonder, like, you know, can I keep going? Do I have the time for this? I think about some people's lives that they don't even get those choices.
Right.
That they're stuck. And we can change that. And I think there's some transformation. There's some riding that ripple out into what's next. that we get an opportunity to do and to tell the story as we're training and experiencing that. That's pretty powerful. And, you know, and I think all of us think a message like this, everything we're talking about, not just what Mike's talking about, we think this is for someone else. Other people need to hear this. They need to know this. And but God's talking to each and every one of us individually. And you're running it, huh? Yeah. Okay. And you're training people?
Yep.
And show them how to do it? Okay.
Yep. I picked up the rope piece over here, and I thought it was interesting. It kind of grabbed my attention. There you go, the rope. It says, real growth happens when you make an effort. Well, a marathon's quite an effort. Real growth can happen during that, not just for you, but for this community and for a community on the other side of the world, very specifically. I will be helping. I'm already signed up for Twin Cities Marathon. I love it. The hardest part is making that decision that you're going to do it. And if you're out there thinking, you know what, I have a little glimmer of thought that, you know, I may be able to do this. I don't know how I would do it. I don't know if I could. If you're even thinking, this is something that I'd like to try, I would love to talk with you more about it. I have I don't have information right now. I would like to gather some information from you if you're interested. And just get your email and your name, and we'll kind of figure out what the next step is over the next few weeks to have that. I think over the last few years, there have been
quite a few people.
Yeah, a couple dozen people that have done it each year, and you all have done, you've support. I mean, a lot of you have seen Twin Cities Marathon running past this neighborhood.
We actually we meet at mile 16 on the course on the day of.
Which is awesome. You see all shapes and sizes and ages going past you at the marathon. And if you've never run a step before, you can still do this. If you've run a lot before, you can still do this. We have plenty of time before October to get you ready for finishing the marathon and being a part of something bigger than yourself.
Great. So you meet with folks just over
yeah,
there?
Yeah, I'll be over here. I have some contact information for you to have. And I would also say check out, not that.
The Kind Site?
Check out mykindsite.org. It has a lot of information on it.
It's on your Sunday paper.
So yeah, I saw that. Yep.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. And so if you're just wanting to... If God is tugging on you about that, just go talk to him and you can figure it out later. So that's good. So last thing, quickly, if the more perceptive ones among you have noticed that there's a door behind me. Okay. And so what is that all about? I won't read the whole thing, but one of the things in John chapter 10 Jesus uses, he says, I am the door. So I'm mixing metaphors with us here. You're going to have to, you know, hang with me. All right. The scissors and the glue, but and I am the door. So Jesus said, when you go through the door, I am the door to life. I am the door to what you're looking for. Now, how this has been spun so much, and I think how most of us perceive this, and why a lot of people aren't interested in Jesus, and they aren't interested in the churches, they see this door as going into a very little room with very little light. I am now in the Christian cult, and I've got to be one of them, and they tell me what to do and how to behave and what the world looks like, and I don't think I want to go in that. I don't want to go through that door. All right, I'm going to stay on this side where it's nice and safe. All right, boxes in a room, or is it ripples ever expanding, looking outward? I will propose that we are all right now in our little room with the lights turned off. And this door, which is Jesus, and is ever expanding, is where the world is. And Jesus invites us to the big, wide world where we get to be glue. So let's walk through it. Amen.